We're continuing our study of the historical introduction, still looking at the response of Israel. As we get to verse 18 of chapter 1, this response now reveals Judah's progressive failure. Verse 18. Also Judah took Gaza with its territory, Ashkelon with its territory, and Ekron with its territory. So the Lord was with Judah, and they drove out the mountaineers, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland, because they had chariots of iron. And they gave Hebron to Caleb, as Moses had said. Then he expelled from there the three sons of Anak. But the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who inhabited Jerusalem. So the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. In verse 18, only three cities are mentioned, Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron. But there were five Philistine cities. The other two were Gath and Ashdod. So here already we see that Judah is only 60% successful. Verse 19 gives the impression that the reasons they had trouble conquering the lowland area was that the people there had chariots of iron. But the problem really was not the iron chariots, as we will see later. And remember that King David had his greatest victories without chariots at all. No, the real problem was diminished faith, which led to diminished power. The Lord was with Judah, but this compromise led to major trouble later. These plains which the Canaanites controlled were in the center of the land and divided Judah and Simeon from the other tribes. This led to cultural division and then troubles and eventually to a complete split into two kingdoms, Israel and Judah. But some of the seeds of this calamity were planted way back here in the time of Judges. Also note the small but crucial difference between verse 19, they could not drive out, and verse 21, they did not drive out. This decline started with not trusting God to do what he promised, they could not, and ended with them giving up, they did not. There is another contrast noted in verse 20 and 21 between faithful senior citizen Caleb, he expelled, he drove out the giants from Hebron, and the Benjamites, who could not drive out regular-sized people from Jerusalem. The record now turns to another set of tribes and describes a similar two-part response. Joseph's initial faithfulness. Let's pick it up at verse 22. And the house of Joseph also went up against Bethel, and the Lord was with them. So the house of Joseph sent men to spy out Bethel. The name of the city was formerly Luz. And when the spies saw a man coming out of the city, they said to him, "Please show us the entrance to the city, and we will show you mercy." So he showed them the entrance to the city, and they struck the city with the edge of the sword. But they let the man and all his family go. The house of Joseph refers to the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, from the two sons of Joseph, which are normally spoken of as separate tribes. But God refers to them as the combined tribe of Joseph, especially when he wants to highlight their faithfulness, as he does here. However, just as we saw with Judah and Benjamin, the response of the tribe of Joseph was also marked by progressive failure. Verse 27. However, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth-shean and its villages, or Taanach and its villages, or the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Ibleam and its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages, for the Canaanites were determined to dwell in that land. And it came to pass when Israel was strong that they put the Canaanites under tribute, but did not completely drive them out. Nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites who dwelt in Gezer, so the Canaanites dwelt in Gezer among them. Did you notice that now the Bible speaks of them as Manasseh and Ephraim, not Joseph? We're looking at failure here, not faithfulness. Five cities were not conquered by Manasseh. Five can be a number related to strength, the five fingers of a hand, for example. So perhaps a hint that the Canaanites retained a firm grasp on the land because they were determined to dwell in that land, as verse 27 puts it. By the time we get to all the other tribes, it's all bad news. Look at verse 30. Nor did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants of Kitron, or the inhabitants of Nahalol. So the Canaanites dwelt among them and were put under tribute. Notice the degrees of compromise seen among God's people. The first degree of compromise was that the Canaanites continued to live among them. We saw this already in verses 27 through 29, and here it is again in verse 30. This was a direct violation of God's command. The second degree of compromise was that Israel lives among the Canaanites. Verse 31. Nor did Asher drive out the inhabitants of Akko, or the inhabitants of Sidon, or of Alab, Akzib, Helba, Aphek, or Rehob. So the Asherites dwelt among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. Nor did Naphtali drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh, or the inhabitants of Beth Anath, but they dwelt among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land. Nevertheless, the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh and Beth Anath were put under tribute to them. So now we see that Asher fails to conquer seven cities, worse now than Manasseh. And Naphtali fails to conquer two cities which were centers of idolatrous cults of the Canaanites. Beth Shemesh was a center for the worship of the sun god, and Beth Anath was known for worship of the Canaanite fertility goddess. The third degree of compromise. It gets worse. The Canaanites drive out the children of God. Verse 34. And the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains, for they would not allow them to come down to the valley. And the Amorites were determined to dwell on Mount Heres, in Aijalon, and in Shalbim. Yet when the strength of the house of Joseph became greater, they were put under tribute. Now the boundary of the Amorites was from the ascent of Akrabim, from Selah, and upward. Notice that the Amorites persisted in living in the very area where Joshua had earlier defeated them, through God's miracle of having the sun stand still in the valley of Aijalon. What a sad contrast with their former victory. And the Amorites even have their own border. The writer of the book of Judges, who was probably Samuel, is carefully emphasizing the increasing deterioration involved in the story of God's people here. G. Campbell Morgan comments that religious apostasy never begins with intellectual questioning. It begins with toleration for the things that are out of harmony with the holiness of God. It was true in Israel's day. It's true in our day, too. Let's note two more aspects of their failure. First of all, there was spiritual failure. They compromised on God's command, revealing partial obedience, not wholehearted obedience. At the root of their spiritual failure was a lack of faith in the God who had led them this far, so they simply didn't obey his command fully. We could note two examples here. They did not drive out this tribe and that group. And in verse 6, we find them copying the pagan practice of mutilation rather than putting Adoni-Bezek to death. Another partial obedience, as we see them beginning to draw their standards from the people around them. And then secondly, there was a materialistic failure. Verse 28 tells us they put the Canaanites under tribute. That is, they forced them to work as slaves. In other words, they valued slaves more than their covenant promise to God. We've seen the Lord's command and Israel's response. Now we turn to the evaluation of the Lord. Chapter 2, verse 1. Then the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim, and said, I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land of which I swore to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall tear down their altars. But you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this? Therefore I also said, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall be thorns in your side, and their gods shall be a snare to you. So it was, when the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the children of Israel, that the people lifted up their voices and wept. Then they called the name of that place Bochim, and they sacrificed there to the Lord. This is rather an appropriate conclusion to this opening introduction of Judges, isn't it? Note the geographic movement here. The angel of the Lord, by the way, this phrase refers to a theophany, an appearance of the Lord himself. It's a phrase which appears 19 times in Judges, more than any other Bible book. The angel of the Lord goes from Gilgal to Bochim. Scholars are not sure of the location of Bochim, but it might have been near Bethel. up in the mountains. The geographic movement may well have been up from the Jordan River Valley to the central mountains, but the spiritual movement is the opposite. In the book of Joshua, Gilgal was a place of victory and blessing. Bochim, by contrast, is a place of weeping and judgment. Compromise has already led to catastrophe. This first chapter of Judges is the most striking chapter in the Bible about the consequences of compromise and partial obedience. God's covenant involved two fairly simple demands. First of all, make no covenants with the Canaanites. And secondly, do not permit any Canaanite altars to stand. But the people did not obey the Lord. So God asks, "Why have you done this?" God's questions in the Bible are designed to provoke self-examination. We have responsibility for our actions, and God treats us as responsible persons. A major theme in Judges involves these two sins of God's people, which are summarized later in chapter 3, verse 6. The first one is adulterous covenanting. Appendix 2 of the book of Judges, chapters 19 through 21, deals with the Levites' failure to protect Israel from adultery. And the second major theme, idolatry. Appendix number 1, chapters 17 and 18, will deal with the Levites' failure to protect Israel from idolatry. God predicted that the Canaanites would become thorns in their sides, a constant irritation and painful problem. And their false gods would become snares under the feet of God's people, tripping them up. Maybe we could hope that with enough tripping, perhaps Israel will be driven to its knees. But the use of the word snare in verse 3 indicates that more than tripping would be involved. This very likely refers to a bird trap still used in Palestine. The bird is attracted, it enters the trap, which triggers a spring which in turn knocks down or pierces the bird. So the reality is that the Canaanites would be the traps enticing Israel into the snare, where they would be pinned down by the false gods they have come to worship. The snare of idolatry will be explored in the history of Gideon, and the snare of adultery will be explored in the history of Samson. As God pronounces his evaluation, the people call the place weeping. But is this the weeping of true repentance? Or is it more superficial, concerned with the consequences only? When God confronts us with our sin, what kind of weeping results? Just a sorrow for consequences? Or a sorrow that turns us around in true repentance from disobedience to obedience?